weather's on the rise. Just a silence before the storm.
Starting this week, storm warnings issued by the National Weather Service will sound a little different. We'll tell you why as jet streaming gets underway.
Stay inside. Don't go out no more. If I had a knife.
Hello and welcome to Jet Streaming. We're one of the few weather-related podcasts available on the web, and we are glad you've joined us. I'm Kathy Werzer with Minnesota Public Radio, along with my co-host, meteorologist Paul Huttner. How's the week been, Paul?
Hi, Kathy. Looking good here as we ease into fall, and boy, it's starting to feel like it, at least in parts of the country.
A little bit, yeah. Let's begin with some weather-related news headlines. After looking rather anemic, Tropical Storm Karen strengthened early Wednesday in the open Atlantic Ocean while a tropical depression is swirling in the southwestern Gulf of Mexico. Various world aid agencies are warning that the humanitarian crisis in Africa could deepen because of record rainfalls and flooding on that continent. More than 1.5 million people have been affected and more than 300 have died. It's a little unusual, but it happened. A flurry of tornadoes caused damage in a number of towns in central and southern England on Monday of this week, but no casualties were reported, thank goodness. In a related story in this country, beginning October the 1st, the National Weather Service will launch a revamped system for issuing severe weather warnings. As you all know, watches and warnings have been issued for years based on the name of the counties affected. And now the Weather Service will issue warnings based on geographic locators, say specific towns or even well-known geographic landmarks. I'm wondering, as a meteorologist, Paul, what's your initial read of this change?
Well, my initial read is, Kathy, it's probably a good idea. But, you know, as a broadcaster, my question is, how will the public adjust? We've trained everybody for decades to know your county, and these warnings have been issued by counties previously. So I'm curious how they're going to be worded. Will they focus on cities? Will counties still be included in the text? Looking forward to asking our guest about that today.
Well, joining us with more on this is meteorologist Mike Looney of the Central Region National Weather Service headquarters in Kansas City. Hello, Mike. Welcome to Jet Streaming.
Good morning, Kathy and Paul. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for being here. Well, let's just get right to it. What's behind the change?
Well, there's a little different perspective of the change. The change, we will be issuing warnings based on threat areas, storm location, not specifically to geographical areas or geographical points, but more toward the threat. When we began this initiative, we called it or referred to it as a polygon warning approach. It's since evolved to a storm-based warning approach. So we are warning on threat area is really the prime focus.
Mike, Paul Huttner here. I'm curious, a little bit about my first question. Specific geography, how will it be relayed to people? As a broadcaster, you know, when severe weather is threatening, we want to let our public know in as clear a fashion as possible what areas are under a threat and immediately. So how will those warnings change from what we're doing now?
Well, historically, as you mentioned, we have warned by counties because we could. It was identifiable, as you mentioned. There was an entity there. There was someone who was responsible for a county. And the communication systems were, you know, text, alphanumeric text. That was the only way we could communicate. So we communicated by county because it was the best way to communicate. Today we can communicate more in a digital approach. So we can say, rather than an entire county, we can say this area is under threat, and it might be portions of one or two counties. So we are able to be more precise with the warning. Visually, this is quite easily done because what you will see on the National Weather Service website, you will actually see the polygons drawn, so you'll know the area. For television media, it's something they have done for a long time, that they would draw the threat area much like a Monday Night Football sort of thing. The key and the question you've asked is, how do you communicate that over the radio or in text.
Mm-hmm.
My position is that since the size of the warnings will be significantly, the size of the area will be significantly smaller, that gives us an opportunity to be more precise. That opens up some other questions is, you know, which references do you pick? And that's where the local offices make that decision and design their warning templates.
Which leads me to this question here. You know, storms can change direction or pop up in other places beyond the warned area and do some strange things. How will this new system respond to something like that?
That's a very good question. And a question that is prime in our training process. To be able to diagnose the storms, and also certainly technology has helped us with that. What we'll see is that the areas warned will be smaller, as I mentioned, but not so small that you can't accommodate the developing system. So it's a training issue, it's a technology issue for the forecasters to properly diagnose the storms. Movement.
Mike, curious if you've done any studies on how the number of warnings might change. Do you think this will reduce the overall number of warnings, or could it increase it?
We did a test in severe weather season 2005 involving 23 forecast offices in the 48 states. What will happen is that the number of warnings should be similar. It's, in a way, it's an internal accounting process, because now if we issue a warning now, today, and one warning but for four counties, we consider that four warnings. So now if we issue this storm-based warning for that same area, we'll consider that one warning. So in that regard, the number of the actual accounting numbers will go down.
You cut down then on kind of false alarms in a sense?
The area falsely alarmed is the way we refer to it, the area falsely alarmed. The area that the forecaster never intended to warn in the first place. In other words, if your tornado, you expect the tornado to hit in the middle of a county. Today you warn for the whole county, so that half of the county is falsely warned right away.
So really this should get folks, if it works right, this should get folks then a little more keyed into their area, and with any luck then take these warnings a little more seriously?
Exactly. If you are warned, let's say, 60% less often for a tornado, just simply because we're no longer warning for areas that we didn't intend to warn for anyway, then it'll have more credibility. You'll be falsely alarmed. There's going to be false alarms, of course. For tornadoes, for example, or affect very small areas. But if you are falsely alarmed less, then you will have more credibility.
All right. We'll see what happens. Thank you, Mike.
Okay.
We've been talking to Mike Looney. He's with the National Weather Service headquarters in Kansas City.
Everybody knows that a love like ours will never die. When everything in the garden is growing so high.
Picture this. You want to spend a chunk of money landscaping your property. You want all kinds of lovely flowers and shrubs and trees. And after you spend a lot of money and do all the work, you begin noticing that those flowers and shrubs and trees are not looking so hot. You thought you planted all the right things, but conditions turn out not to be the best for the varieties you selected. What went wrong? It could be the microclimate in your area, perhaps. Or just bad gardening. Joining us right now with more is meteorologist Karen Falloon, who is also with Outdoor Environments. She is a landscape design consultant there. It's always good to see you, my dear. How are you?
Good to see you, too. Very well, thanks.
You know, what the heck is a microclimate?
You know, I heard you, that little introduction there, you know, folks, the plant material starts to die and people can't figure out why. Well, it could be a number of things, but most times when people go to the garden center, they're only thinking about the zone they're in, whether it be 4 or 5 or 3, and they zero in on those plants and think, that's it, that's what I need, just zone 4 if I'm in zone 4. And then they can't figure out why. It, you know, happens that, you know, stuff just fails when they get it home and they get it planted. Well, you're right on the money when you say you have to think about microclimates. Microclimate is a very small, well, it's a mini climate, right? You know, it's micro makes it sound really scientific, but it's a mini climate. And let's see if we can put this in terms where you could think of it as your own, in your own yard. Think about your house. Let's start there. Your house has rooms. Some of the rooms are sunnier. Some of the rooms are shadier. Some have a little bit more moisture. Others are very dry. So you have mini climates in your own home. Now you have to translate that into the outdoors. You have to take a look at your yard and take a look at you know, what's going on, because things in your yard, it makes a huge difference. If there's a stand of trees and then you have a very nice over canopy over the yard area, that area of the yard is going to be warmer than an open area. You know, some parts of your yard are windier, depending on which direction the house faces, than other parts of the yard where it might be a bit more protected. Fences, walls, buildings, all, you know, we create those protected areas like a courtyard. Those are all different sorts of mini climates. So if you look at your yard in terms of it being rooms of a house and try to figure out different spots in your yard, and it's not just the back of the house, the front of the house, and both sides. There's more than four rooms. I mean, if you have in my backyard, I have a very open, sunny area, which is right up against a fence, and it gets very hot. I don't want to put tender plant material in there. I need more drought-tolerant material. I need something that can withstand the heat. And in another half, the other side of my yard, it's underneath a very dense maple tree. And so I need to put material underneath there that doesn't need quite so much sun, that maybe warmer plant. Maybe that's a zone 5 plant that can go in there.
No.
So you can, in your own yard, have different zones. Huh. Zone 4 in some areas, maybe zone 5, maybe some places you can only have zone 3 plants. So you have to take a look at your own yard and sort of dissect what's going on out there.
How's your yard looking, Paul?
You know, it looks pretty darn good. Whoever designed all my plants, I think has them all in the right spot, and I'm guilty of the bad gardening thing, so I'm glad somebody else did it that was a professional. But Karen, you know, I wanted to ask you, I've seen some studies, maybe you've seen these too, that can show a 10 to 15 degree difference, for example, at night in a valley versus on a hill, very nearby. There's a study at the University of Arizona I saw. How significant is a microclimate around the average home on different sides of the house in terms of temperature, and how do you guys take that into account when you're designing?
It can easily be as much as 10 degrees in your own yard, depending on how big your yard is. Obviously, if you have this little postage stamp sized yard, it's not going to be that much of a difference. But say, as an example, everybody, every spring we have people calling in saying, you know, oh, my crocuses are coming up. My plants on the south side of the house are coming up. You know, the trees on the south side of my house are blooming. And then, of course, we go to frost and all of that is lost. That is easily the ground thaws faster on the south side of your house. It's up against a wall, then it's going to be at least 10 degrees warmer. So, but on the north side of the house, which is still much protected, maybe the ground is still frozen. So there is quite a big difference, even in your own yard. And it doesn't have to be valleys versus hilltops. It could just be within your own backyard that you have that much of a difference. You just have to pay attention. Map out your yard. Start by drawing the plot of your yard, the area of your yard within the property lines. Then place the houses, the trees, the fences, the patios, the decks. And then start to pay attention as to what goes on in that part of your yard. Those people who live in the woods, you know, I've been dealing with some folks that live in a very wooded area. Now, the microclimate in that, maybe not varying so much because it's not open to the skies. You don't radiate that heat at night. You don't have the temperature loss that you would, you know, in a very open area. But underneath those trees, you know, there's not so much light. So you're limited on your plant material. Well, here's a solution. Thin out the canopy and do that on a regular basis. It's healthy for the tree. And as you thin out the canopy, you provide more light around the house and in your yard, and you have a greater selection of plant material.
Does some of your advice, Karen, also deal with if you have just raw land and you want to build a house? I mean, we're talking about gardening here, but the same principles apply, correct, in terms of a microclimate, if you're going to build, say, a new house?
Absolutely. You should figure out the directions. You start first, you know, like I say, draw your property line, then figure out where north is and the subsequent other directions. Figure out where those directions are, and then which direction do you want your house facing? I think that, you know, if you paid attention, my house faces south. I love that idea. My house is warmer in the wintertime because I get the sun. I have deciduous trees in the front, so the trees lose their leaves. I don't have that shade. The sun is free to come in the front part of that house. Also, if you're driving down the street, you'll notice that my front yard thaws out faster and greens up faster. That lawn is green quicker than the opposite side of the street that faces north. So you have to figure out where you want your house to face. Some people don't have that choice, but you need to make the plant selections based on which direction your house is facing.
Karen, I saw recently that some of the climate zones that you talked about, zone 3, zone 4, zone 5, have they shifted some of those because of what we're seeing with climate change? And what does that mean for places like Minnesota?
Well, it does. It has gotten zone 5, say, for instance, you know, because of the climate conditions and the warming, the zone 5, there's more places reporting zone 5 climate conditions in southern Minnesota. Even a few parts of the metro area could be zone 5.
And again, for goofballs like me, what would that mean?
That would mean that some of the plant material that you could plant might, a long time ago, might have only survived in Iowa.
Okay.
Or southern Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So with the warmer temperatures creeping farther and farther north, you know, then you can plant that kind of plant material here. I wouldn't say that it's an entire metro area. I would still say count on zone 4 plant material until you can tell what the microclimates are in your yard. You have to look at about 6 different factors. You have to look at temperature, moisture, light, and wind exposure. Those are the 4 climate-related things to look at in your yard. Then earth-related are soil and terrain. Believe it or not, sandy soil versus a clay soil makes a difference, not just in what kind of plant material thrives, but even on temperatures. Sandy soil has air pockets or more air that really in the subsoils that keeps temperatures a little bit warmer, that perhaps you don't see frost. It's not as susceptible to frost. And clay soils act like a paved surface, and they radiate heat. And so that radiated heat and the temperatures at the surface cool down faster, and you might see temperatures that are closer to the freezing mark or frost point where you might lose plant material. So your soil type does make a difference. And as far as terrain goes, drainage.
Uh-huh.
Huge. If you have a high part of your yard, you'll find that the lower spots, not only will it remain wetter, but it will be slightly cooler than, say, the higher parts of your yard.
Which is explaining now here, Paul, as I'm listening to Karen, this is why my plants are dying or are dead already. You know, this isn't good.
I hear you. And I guess I'm very fortunate whoever designed our yard did everything just right. The hostas and ferns, the shade-loving things on the north side of our home, the lilacs on the south side. And, you know, I guess I like what Karen talked about, because I think about an ideal home microclimate in Minnesota, and you think south or southwest sloping lot, hopefully, mm-hmm. Pines to the north, and then shade trees on the east and west side of your homes especially, because in the summer that will greatly reduce the amount of incoming solar radiation and really saves a lot on your energy bills. And like Karen said too, it's good to have those shade trees on the south side of the home and not those pine trees on the south side.
That's very true. For wind protection, if you plant those pines, say, on the north or northwest side, you have that protection from the northwest winds, which are very drying winds. And some of the evergreen plant material that you can put out there do not like those drying winds. Evergreens don't have the ability to replace that moisture when the ground is frozen, like, you know, other plant material might. So it dries out very quickly and then goes into the spring. That's why we tell people, water your evergreens right up until the ground freezes, so that soil, that water is locked in the soil and the evergreen has something to tap into right away.
I never do that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
You need to start doing that. But, you know, the whole sandy soil, you know, you have to maybe water a bit more with sandy soils because it dries out so much quicker than clay soils. And so you have to determine what kind of soils you have in your yard and what your drainage is like. And that makes a huge, huge difference.
You both are meteorologists, and Paul kind of alluded to this earlier, Karen, about how zones could be changing. You know, if you look out in your crystal ball, what do you think might happen in terms of as the climate starts to warm up here? What kind of material might you be using, say, in maybe 5 years or so in terms of plant material?
I don't know that I couldn't guess. I wouldn't know that. I don't think it would change quite that quick that you would see such a huge change, because people will still plant the kind of material. I mean, we can plant zone 2 material and it will thrive here. It just means that it will, you can also plant it in far northern Minnesota or up in, you know, just across the border in Canada. So I don't know that it will change a whole lot. Where we will see the changes will be in the trees, the kind of trees and the forests and what suddenly becomes dominant, what has been dominant in the past. And it's even changing now. So you will see the forests change.
And if you look at the climate of Minnesota, it is a great microcosm of these different climate zones already. The Southwest, we have the prairie landscape, and then transition to the deciduous forest from the metro and much of central Minnesota to the coniferous or pine forests of northern Minnesota. Those zones may tend to shift north as well in terms of what natural vegetation grows. But, and Karen may know more about this, but I'm guessing that even though we'll be able to plant some plants here that used to only grow south of here, we're still going to get the extreme cold in the winter, even if it doesn't last as long. And that may prevent some of the warmer species from thriving in Minnesota.
That's very true. And it will mean that a lot more protection. You have to give some plant material a lot more protection. Some of the plant material that we plant now is right for that, that cold, that extreme cold, so we don't have to worry about it quite so much. But we'll start, it'll be a whole lot more maintenance to our yard if we start planting material that maybe isn't made for the cold.
So a lot more mulching.
And we create, like I said, we create microclimates. Like a greenhouse is a microclimate. If you have a little greenhouse in your backyard, that's a microclimate. Cold frames, you know, when you start annuals indoors and you have to harden them off, you start bringing them outside, and a cold frame is maybe nothing more than a lean-to that maybe catches the sun's heat if you put it in the right direction, so that you could take the annuals outside and then bring them in at night, take them out during the day, leave them for longer and longer periods in the colder temperatures. So some people are very active in their yards and don't mind that kind of maintenance and don't mind, you know, shuffling that material in and out of the house. But, you know, we create the microclimates in our backyard. You can plant a stand of trees and create a microclimate. A pool, a pond, there's bodies of water always moderate temperatures. And so you could create, you know, just by adding some water to your backyard, you can create a microclimate where you might be able to plant some material that would be maybe more zone 5 than 4.
Excellent. You know, it was fun having you in, Karen Falloon.
Thank you. It's fun being here.
Karen Falloon is with Outdoor Environments. She is a landscape design consultant. Paul, I believe it is time for the weather website of the week.
Yep.
We're going to have to get rid of that thunderclap, you know that.
Oh, no.
What are you
going to
do for the winter now? Maybe blizzard sounding?
There you go. Blizzard, ice cracking, something like that.
Yes.
You know, we've heard so much thunder lately, it's certainly applicable. This weather side of the week, I think, is really what we call in the business more news you can use. It's a way to keep track of sunrise and sunset. It's called sunrisesunset.com. And basically what you can do is you can plug in virtually any location, and it will pull up a monthly table of sunrise and sunset. It will include twilight, if you're interested in that, and the moon phases. So it's kind of nice for planning trips and vacations or weddings in the weather biz. We get a lot of questions. Paul, my daughter's getting married 3 weeks from now. What time does the sun set? And so sunrisesunset.com, quick and easy way to keep track of when the sun's coming up and the sun's going down.
As a matter of fact, I'm on that site right now. I see in Honolulu, Hawaii, the sunset is at 6:25.
Oh,
sure,
that sounds good. Yeah, I'd like to be there.
Thank you, Paul. We will talk to you next week.
Thanks, Kathy. Thanks, Karen.
By the way, friends, we are still looking for interested science classes to partner with us in cooking up a weather-related segment here on Jet Streaming. If you are a science teacher, drop us a line. We'll talk about how your class could find a wider audience for a specific project. You can drop us a line by going to the podcast section of MinnesotaPublicRadio.org. Click on Jet Streaming. Until next week, remember to keep your eyes on the sky.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the